were adversaries, and Rowan found it increasingly hard to parse his feelings about her. All he knew was that he liked watching her write. Scythe Faraday was strict on his no-family policy. It is ill-advised for you to have contact with your family during your apprenticeship. It was difficult for Citra. She missed her parents, but more than that, she missed her brother, Ben, which surprised her, because at home she never had much patience for him. Rowan seemed to have no problem with being separated from his family. They'd much rather have their immunity than have me around anyway, he told Citra.
Boo-hoo,
Citra said.
Am I supposed to feel sorry for you?
Not at all. Envious, maybe. It makes it easier for me to leave it all behind. Scythe Faraday did bend his own rule once, however. About a month in, he allowed Citra to attend her aunt's wedding. While everyone else was dressed in gowns and tuxedos, Scythe Faraday did not allow Citra to dress up. Lest you feel yourself a part of that world. It worked. Wearing simple street clothes amid the pageantry made her feel even more the outsider, and the apprentice armband made it worse. Perhaps this was the reason Faraday allowed her to attend, to make crystal clear the distinction between who she had been and who she was now.
So, what's it like?
Asked her cousin Amanda.
Gleaning and stuff, is it, like, gross? We're not allowed to talk about it, Citra told her.
Which was not true, but she had no interest in discussing gleaning like it was school gossip. She should have nurtured that conversation, however, instead of shutting it down, because Amanda was one of the few people who spoke to her. There were plenty of sideways glances and people talking about her when they thought she wasn't watching. But most everyone avoided her, like she carried a mortal age disease. Perhaps if she already had her ring, they might try to curry favor in hopes of receiving immunity. But apparently, as an apprentice, she offered them nothing but the creeps. Her brother was standoffish, and even speaking to her mother was awkward. She asked standard questions like,
Are you eating?
And,
Are you getting enough sleep?
I understand there's a boy living with you, her father said.
He has his own room, and he's not interested in me at all,
she told him, which she found oddly embarrassed to admit. Citra sat through the wedding ceremony but excused herself before the reception and took a public car back to Scythe Faraday's house, unable to bear another minute of it.
You're back early,
Scythe Faraday commented when she returned. And although he feigned surprise, he had set her a place for dinner. Scythes are supposed to have a keen appreciation of death, yet there are some things that are beyond even our comprehension. The woman I gleaned today asked me the oddest question. Where do I go now? She asked.
Well, I explained calmly. Your memories and life recording are already stored in the Thunderhead, so it won't be lost. Your body is returned to the Earth in a manner determined by your next of kin.
Yes, I know all that, she said.
But what about me?
The question perplexed me.
As I said, your memory construct will exist in the Thunderhead. Loved ones will be able to talk to it, and your construct will respond, yes, she said, getting a bit agitated. But what about me?
I gleaned her then. Only after she was gone did I say, I don't know.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 8. A Matter of Choice.
I will glean alone today, Scythe Faraday told Rowan and Citra one day in February, the second month of their apprenticeship. While I am gone, I have a task for each of you.
He took Citra into the weapons den.
You, Citra, shall polish each of my blades.
She'd been in the weapons den nearly every day for lessons. But to be there alone, nothing but her and instruments of death was entirely different. The scythe went to the blade wall, which had everything from swords to switchblades.
Some are merely dusty, others tarnished. You shall decide what type of care each one needs.
She watched the way his eyes moved from one blade to another, lingering long enough, perhaps, to recall a memory.
You've used them all?
She asked.
Only about half of them. Not even then, for only one gleaning.
He reached up and pulled a rapier from the fourth wall, the one with the older-looking weapons. This one looked like the kind one of the three musketeers might have used.
When I was young,
I had much more of a flair for drama. I went to glean a man who fancied himself a fencer. So I challenged him to a duel.
And you won?
No. I lost. Twice. He skewered me through the neck the first time, and tore open my femoral artery the second. He was very good. Each time, after I woke up in the revival center, I returned to challenge him. His wins bought him time, but he was chosen to be gleaned, and I would not relent. Some scythes will change their minds, but that leads to compromise, and it favors the persuasive. I make my decisions firm. In the fourth bout, I pierced his heart with the tip of my blade. As he breathed his last, he thanked me for allowing him to die fighting. It was the only time in all my years as a scythe that I had been thanked for what I do. He sighed, and put the rapier back in what Citra realized was a place of honor.
If you have all these weapons, why did you take our knife the day you came to glean my neighbor?
Citra had to ask. The scythe grinned. To gauge your reaction.
I threw it away, she told him.
I suspected as much, he said. But these, you will polish. Then he left her there. When he was gone, Citra studied the weapons. She was not particularly morbid, but she found herself wanting to know which blades had been used and how. It seemed to her that a noble weapon deserved to have its story passed down. And if not to her and Rowan, then who? She pulled a scimitar from the wall, a heavy beast that could decapitate you with a single swing. Had Scythe Faraday used it for a beheading? It was, in a way, his style. Swift, painless, efficient. As she moved it clumsily through the air, she wondered if she had the strength to behead someone.
My God, what am I becoming?
She put the weapon on the table, grabbed the rag and rubbed polish on it. And when she finished, she went to the next, and the next, trying not to see her reflection in each of the gleaming blades. Rowan's task was not as visceral, but was even more troubling. Today, you shall lay the groundwork for my next gleaming, Scythe Faraday told him, then gave him a list of parameters that tomorrow's subject should have. All the information you need is in the Thunderhead, if you're clever enough to find it. Then he left for the day's gleaning. Rowan almost made the mistake of giving the list of parameters to the Thunderhead and asking it for a subject, until he remembered that asking the Thunderhead for assistance was strictly forbidden for scythes. They had full access to the Great Cloud's wealth of information, but could not access its algorithmic, conscious mind. Scythe Faraday had told them of a scythe who had tried to do so. The Thunderhead itself reported him to the High Blade, and he was severely disciplined. How is a scythe disciplined? Rowan had asked. He was put to death 12-fold by a jury of scythes, then revived each time. After the 12th revival, he was on probation for a year. Rowan imagined a jury of scythes would be very creative in their methods of punishment. He suspected that dying 12 times at the hands of scythes would be a lot worse than splatting. He began to enter search parameters. He was instructed to have his search include not just their city, but all of Mid-America, which stretched nearly 1,000 miles across the middle of the continent. Then he narrowed the search to towns with populations under 10,000 that were also on the banks of rivers, then to homes or apartments that were within 100 feet of the riverbank. Then he searched for people 20 and older who lived in those residences. That gave him more than 40,000 people. He had done that in 5 minutes. The next few requirements were not going to be as easy to nail down. The subject must be a strong swimmer. He got a list of every high school and university in each river town and cross-referenced everyone who had been on a swim team for the past 20 years or had registered for a triathlon. About 800 people. The subject must be a dog lover. Using Scythe Faraday's access code, he found the subscription lists of every publication and blog dealing with dogs. He accessed pet store databases to get a list of anyone who made regular purchases of dog food over the past few years. That brought the number down to 112 names. The subject must have a history of heroism in a non-professional capacity. He painstakingly searched for words like hero, bravery, and rescue for all 112 names. He thought he'd be lucky if a single one came up, but to his surprise, 4 of them were noted as having done something heroic at some point in their lives. He clicked on each name and brought up four pictures. He immediately regretted it, because the moment those names had faces, they became people instead of parameters. A man with a round face and a winning smile. A woman who could have been anyone's mother. A guy with a bad case of bed hair. A man who looked like he hadn't shaved in 3 days. Four people. And Rowan was about to decide which one would die tomorrow. He immediately found himself leaning toward the unshaven man, but realized he was showing a bias. A person shouldn't be discriminated against because he hadn't shaved for a picture. And was he ruling out the woman just because she was a woman? Okay, then. The guy with the smile. But was Rowan overcompensating now by choosing the most pleasant-looking of them? He decided to learn more about each of them, using Faraday's access code to dig up more personal information than he really should have been allowed to. But this was a person's life he was dealing with. Shouldn't he use any means necessary to make his decision fair? This one had run into a burning building in his youth to save a family member. But this one has 3 young kids. But this one volunteers at an animal shelter. But this one's brother was gleaned just 2 years ago. He thought each fact would help him. But the more he came to know about each of them, the harder the decision became. He kept digging into their lives, getting more and more desperate until the front door opened, and Scythe Faraday returned. It was dark out. When had night fallen? The Scythe looked weary, and his robes were splattered with blood.
Today's gleaning was more troublesome than expected, he said.
Citra came out of the weapons den.
All blades are now polished to a perfect shine, she announced.
Faraday gave her his nod of approval. Then he turned to Rowan, who still sat at the computer.
And who do we glean next?
I narrowed it down to 4.
And? Said the Scythe.
All 4 fit the profile.
And?
Said the Scythe again.
Well, this one just got married, and this one just bought a house.
Pick 1, said the Scythe.
And this one received a humanitarian award last year.
Pick 1,
yelled the Scythe with a ferocity Rowan had never heard from the man. The very walls seemed to recoil from his voice. Rowan thought he might get a reprieve, as he had when Faraday asked him to hand that woman the cyanide pill, but no. Today's test was very different. Rowan looked to Citra, who still stood in the doorway of the weapons den, frozen like a bystander at an accident. He was truly alone in this awful decision. Rowan looked to the screen, grimacing, and pointed to the man with bed hair.
Him,
Rowan said.
Glean him.
Rowan closed his eyes. He had just condemned a man to death because he'd had a bad hair day. Then he felt Faraday put a firm hand on his shoulder. He thought he'd get a reprimand, but instead the Scythe said,
Well done.
Rowan opened his eyes.
Thank you, sir.
Were this not the hardest thing you've ever done, I'd be concerned.
Does it ever get easier?
Rowan asked.
I certainly hope not, the Scythe said.
The following afternoon, Bradford Ziller returned from work to find a Scythe sitting in his living room. The Scythe stood up as Bradford entered. His instincts told him to turn and run, but before he did, a teenage boy with a green armband who had been standing off to the side closed the door behind him. He waited, with increasing dread for the Scythe to speak, but instead the Scythe gestured to the boy, who cleared his throat and said,
Mr. Ziller, you have been chosen for gleaning.
Tell him the rest, Rowan, said the Scythe patiently.
I mean to say that I chose you for gleaning.
Bradford looked between the two of them, suddenly deeply relieved, because this was clearly some sort of joke.
Okay, who the hell are you? Who put you up to this?
Then the Scythe held up his hand, showing his ring. And Bradford's spirits fell again like the second drop of a roller coaster. That was no fake. It was the real thing.
The boy is one of my apprentices, the Scythe said.
I'm sorry, said the boy. It's not personal, you just fit a certain profile. Back in the Age of Mortality, lots of people died trying to perform rescues. A lot of them were people who jumped into flooded rivers to save their pets. Most of them were good swimmers, but that doesn't matter in a flood.
The dogs, thought Bradford.
That's right, the dogs.
You can't hurt me, he said. You do, and my dogs will rip you to pieces.
But where were they?
Then a girl came out of his bedroom, wearing the same armband as the boy.
I sedated all three, she said. They'll be fine, but they won't be bothering anyone.
There was blood on her arm. Not the dogs, but her own. They had bitten her.
Good for them.
It's not personal, the boy said again. I'm sorry.
One apology is enough, the scythe told the boy, especially when it's genuine.
Bradford guffawed, even though he knew this was real. He just somehow found this funny. His knees weak, he settled onto the sofa, and his laughter resolved into misery. How was this fair? How was any of this fair? But then the boy knelt down before him, and when Bradford looked up, he was caught by the boy's gaze. It was as if he were looking into the eyes of a much older soul.
Listen to me, Mr. Ziller, the boy said.
I know you saved your sister from a fire when you were my age. I know how hard you struggled to save your marriage. And I know you think that your daughter doesn't love you, but she does.
Bradford stared at him incredulous.
How do you know all this?
The boy pursed his lips.
It's our job to know. Your gleaning won't change any of that. You lived a good life. Scythe Faraday is here to complete it for you.
Bradford begged to make a phone call, pleaded for just one more day. But of course those things were not granted. They said he could write a note, but he couldn't bring himself to find anything to write.
I know how that feels, the boy told him.
How will you do it?
He finally asked them. The scythe responded, I have chosen for you a traditional drowning. We shall take you to the river. I shall submerge you until your life leaves you.
Bradford clenched his eyes. I've heard that drowning is a bad way to go.
Can I give him some of the stuff I gave the dogs?
The girl asked.
Knock him out, so that he'll already be unconscious?
The scythe considered it and nodded. If you choose, we can spare you the suffering. But Bradford shook his head, realizing he wanted every second he had left.
No, I want to be awake.
If drowning was to be his last experience, then let him experience it. He could feel his heart beating faster, his body trembling with the surge of adrenaline. He was afraid, but fear meant he was still alive. Come then, the scythe told him gently. We'll all go down to the river together. Citra was awed by how Rowan handled himself. Although he began a little shaky when he first spoke to the man, he took charge. He took the reins of that man's fear and gave him peace. Citra only hoped that when it came her turn to make a choice, she could keep her composure as well as Rowan had. All she had done today was tranquilize a few dogs. Sure, she got bitten in the process, but it was nothing, really. She tried to convince Faraday to take the dogs to a shelter, but he wouldn't have it. He did allow her to call the shelter to come for the dogs, and the coroner to come for the man. The scythe offered to take her to a hospital for some speed healing of the dog bite on her arm, but she declined. Her own nanites would heal it by morning. And besides, there was something compelling about the discomfort. She owed it to the dead man to hurt a little for him.
That was impressive,
she told Rowan on the long ride home.
Yeah, right until I puked on the riverbank.
But that was only after he was gleaned,
Citra pointed out.
You gave that man strength to face death.
Rowan shrugged.
I guess.
Citra found it both maddening and endearing how modest he could be.
There's a poem by Honorable Scythe Socrates, one of the first scythes. He wrote many poems, but this one has grown to be my personal favorite. Have not a hand in the blade with abandon. Cull from the fold all the brazen and bold. For a dog who just might love the bark and the bite is a carrion raven, the craven of old. It reminds me that in spite of our lofty ideals and the many safeguards to protect the scythedom from corruption and depravity, we must always be vigilant, because power comes infected with the only disease left to us, the virus called human nature. I fear for us all, if scythes begin to love what they do.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 9. Esme. Esme ate far too much pizza. Her mother told her pizza would be the death of her.
She never imagined it might actually be true. The scythe attack came less than a minute after she was given her slice, piping hot from the oven. It was the end of the school day, and the daily trials of fourth grade had exhausted her. Lunch had sucked. The tuna salad her mother had given her was warm and mildly fermented by the time lunch rolled around. Not exactly appetizing. In fact, none of the food her mother packed for her hit high on the flavor scale. She was trying to get Esme to eat healthier, because Esme had a bit of a weight problem. And although her nanites could be programmed to speed up her metabolism, her mother wouldn't hear of it. She claimed it would be treating the symptom, not the problem.
"You can't solve everything by tweaking your nanites," her mother told her. "You need to learn self-control."
Well, she could learn self-control tomorrow. Today, she wanted pizza. Her favorite pizza place, Luigi's, was in the food court of the Fulcrum City Galleria, which was on her way home from school. Sort of. She was negotiating the cheese, trying to figure out how to take that first bite without burning the roof of her mouth, when the scythes arrived. Her back was to them, so she didn't see them at first, but she heard them. Or at least one of them.
"Good afternoon, good people," he said. "Your lives are about to change in a fundamental way."
Esme turned to see them. Four of them. They were clad in bright robes that glittered. They looked like no one Esme had ever seen. She had never met a scythe. She was fascinated. Until three of them pulled out weapons that glistened even more than their bejeweled robes, and the fourth pulled out a flamethrower.
"This food court has been selected for gleaning," their leader said.
And they began their terrible mission. Esme knew what she had to do. Forgetting her pizza, she dropped beneath the table and crawled away. But she wasn't the only one. It seemed everyone had dropped and was scrambling on the floor. It didn't seem to faze the scythes. She could see their feet through the crawling crowd. The fact that their victims were on all fours did not slow them down in the least. Now Esme began to panic. She had heard stories of scythes who did mass gleanings, but until now, she thought they were nothing but stories. Before her, she could see the robes of the scythe in yellow, so she doubled back, only to find the scythe in green closing in. Esme crawled through a gap in the tables and between two potted palms that the scythe in orange had set on fire. And when she emerged on the other side of the large pots, she found herself with no cover. She was at the food concessions now. The man who had served her pizza was slumped over the counter, dead. There was a gap between a trash can and the wall. She was not a slim girl, so she thought the skinniest thoughts she could and squeezed her way into the gap. It was not much of a hiding space, but if she left it, she would be right in the line of fire. She had already seen two people trying to dart across the walkway, and both were taken down by steel crossbow arrows. She didn't dare move. So instead, she buried her face in her hands. She stayed that way, sobbing, listening to the terrible sounds around her until silence fell. Still, she refused to open her eyes until she heard a man say,
"Hello there."
Esme opened her eyes to see the lead scythe, the one in blue, standing over her.
"Please," she begged. "Please don't glean me."
The man held out his hand to her.
"The gleaning is over," he said. "There's no one left but you. Now, take my hand."
Afraid to refuse, Esme reached out and placed her hand in his and rose from her hiding place.
"I've been looking for you, Esme," he said.
Esme gasped when she heard him say her name. Why would a scythe be looking for her? The other three scythes gathered round. None of them raised a weapon at her.
"You'll be coming with us now," the scythe in blue said.
But my mother...
"Your mother knows. I've granted her immunity."
"Really?"
"Yes, really."
Then the girl scythe in emerald green handed Esme a plate.
"I believe this was your pizza?"
Esme took it. It was cool enough to eat now.
"Thank you."
"Come with us," said the scythe in blue. "And I promise you from this moment on, your life will be everything you've ever dreamed it could be."
And so Esme left with the four scythes, thankful to be alive, and trying not to think of the many around her who weren't. This was certainly not the way she imagined her day would go. But who was she to fight against something that rang so clearly of destiny?
Was there ever a time when people weren't plagued with boredom? A time when motivation wasn't so hard to come by? When I look at news archives from the age of mortality, it seems people had more reasons to do the things they did. Life was about forging time, not just passing time. And those news reports, how exciting they were. Filled with all nature of criminal activity. Your neighbor could be a salesperson of illegal chemicals of recreation. Ordinary people would take life without the permission of society. Angry individuals would take possession of vehicles they didn't own, then lead law enforcement officials in dangerous pursuits on uncontrolled roadways. We do have the unsavories nowadays, but they do little more than drop occasional pieces of litter and move shop items to places they don't belong. No one rages against the system anymore. At most, they just glare at it a bit. Perhaps this is why the Thunderhead still allows a measured amount of economic inequality. It could certainly make sure that everyone had equal wealth, but that would just add to the plague of boredom that afflicts the immortal. Although we all have what we need, we're still allowed to strive for the things we want. Of course, no one strives like they did in mortal days, when the inequality was so great people would actually steal from one another, sometimes ending lives in the process. I wouldn't want the return of crime, but I do tire of we scythes being the sole purveyors of fear. It would be nice to have some competition. From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 10. Forbidden Responses.
Dude, I'm telling you, it's all anyone can talk about. Everyone thinks you're becoming a scythe to take revenge on the school.
On a mild day in March, on one of the rare afternoons that Scythe Faraday allowed Rowan downtime, Rowan had gone to visit his friend Tiger, who had not splatted once in the past 3 months. Now they shot hoops at a park just a few blocks away from Rowan's home, where he wasn't allowed to visit and might not have even if he were allowed. Rowan threw Tiger the ball.
That's not why I accepted the apprenticeship. I know that. And you know that, but people will believe whatever they want to believe.
He grinned.
Suddenly I got all sorts of game because I'm your friend. They think I can get them access to your ring. Immunity talks, death walks.
The thought of Tiger playing intercessor on his behalf almost made Rowan laugh. He could see Tiger milking that for all it was worth, probably charging people for the service. Rowan stole the ball and took a shot. He hadn't played since before moving in with the scythe, but he found his arm, if not his aim. He was stronger than ever, and had endless stamina, all thanks to his Bokator training.
So when you get your ring, you are going to give me immunity, right?
Tiger took a shot and missed. It was clearly intentional. He was letting Rowan win.
First of all, I don't know that he'll choose me to get the ring, and secondly, I can't give you immunity.
Tiger looked genuinely shocked.
What? Why not? That's playing favorites? Isn't that what friends are for?
A few other kids came to the court and asked if maybe they wanted to play a pickup game. But the second they saw Rowan's armband, they had a change of heart.
No worries, the oldest one said. It's all yours.
It was exasperating.
No, we can all play. Nah, we'll go somewhere else. I said we can all play,
Rowan insisted. And he saw such fear in the other kid's eyes, he felt ashamed for pushing.
Yeah, sure,
said the other kid. He turned to his friends.
You heard the man. Play.
They took to the court in earnest, and in earnest played to lose, just as Tiger had. Was this how it would always be? Was he now such an intimidating presence that even his own friends would be afraid to truly challenge him? The only one who ever challenged him in any way now was Citra. Rowan quickly lost interest in the game and left with Tiger, who found it all amusing.
Dude, you're not lettuce anymore. You're deadly nightshade. You're the mean greens now.
Tiger was right. If Rowan had told those other kids to get down on all fours and lick the pavement, they would have. It was heady and horrible, and he didn't want to think about it. Rowan didn't know what possessed him to do what he did next. Frustration at his old isolation, maybe. Or maybe just wanting to bring a sliver of his old life into his new one.
Want to come over and see the scythe place?
Tiger was a little dubious.
Will he mind? He's not there.
Rowan told him. He's gleaning in another city today. He won't be home till late. He knew that Scythe Faraday would blow a brainstem if he found out Rowan had someone over. It made the desire to do it even more enticing. He had been so good, so obedient. It was about time he did something that he wanted to do. When they arrived, the house was empty. Citra, who also was granted a free afternoon by Scythe Faraday, was out. He had wanted Tiger to meet her, but then thought, what if they happen to like each other? What if Tiger charms her? He always had a way with girls. He had even convinced a girl to splat with him once, just so he could say, girls fall for me. Literally. It'll be like Romeo and Juliet, he had told her. Except we get to come back. Needless to say, the girl's parents were livid, and after she was revived, they forbade her to see Tiger ever again. Tiger shrugged it off. What can I say? Her life is a tale told by idiots. Which Rowan believed was a very bad Shakespeare misquote. The thought of Citra falling for Tiger, even just figuratively, made Rowan a bit nauseated. This is it, Tiger said as he looked around the place. It's just a house. What did you expect, a secret underground lair? Actually, yeah. Or something like it. I mean, look at this furniture. I can't believe he makes you live in this hellhole. It's not so bad. Come on. I'll show you something cool. He took Tiger to the weapons den, which, as expected, Tiger found truly impressive.
This is so edge. I've never seen so many knives. Are those guns? I've only seen pictures.
He took a pistol off the wall and looked in the barrel.
Don't do that.
Calm down. I'm a splatter, not a blaster. Rowan took it away from him anyway, and in the time it took to put it back on the wall, Tiger had taken down a machete and was swishing it through the air.
Think I could borrow this? Absolutely not.
Come on, he's got so many. He'll never miss it. Tiger, Rowan knew, was the very definition of bad idea. That had always been part of the fun of being his friend. But now that was a major liability. Rowan grabbed Tiger's arm, kicked him behind the knee to buckle his leg, spun him to the ground, all in a single buccateur move. Then he held Tiger's arm at an unnatural angle, with just enough leverage for it to hurt.
What the hell?
Tiger said through gritted teeth.
Drop the machete. Now.
Tiger did. And just then, they heard the front door being opened. Rowan let go.
Be quiet,
he said in a power whisper. He peeked out the door, but couldn't see who had come in.
Stay here,
he told Tiger. Then he slipped out to find Citra closing the front door behind her. She must have been running, because she wore a workout outfit that was much more revealing than Rowan needed at the moment. It drained far too much blood from his brain. So he focused on her apprentice armband to remind himself that hormonal responses were strictly forbidden. Citra looked up and gave him an obligatory greeting.
Hey, Rowan.
Hey.
Something wrong?
No.
Why are you just standing there?
Where should I be standing?
She rolled her eyes and went into the bathroom, closing the door. Rowan slipped back into the weapons den.
Who is it?
Asked Tiger.
Is that what's your name?
I want to meet your competition. Maybe she'll give me immunity. Or something else.
No,
Rowan told him.
It's Scythe Faraday, and he'll glean you on the spot if he finds you here.
Suddenly, Tiger's bravado evaporated.
Oh, crap. What are we going to do?
Calm down. He's taking a shower. As long as you're quiet, I can get you out.
They came out into the hallway. Sure enough, the sound of a shower hissed behind the closed bathroom door.
He's washing off the blood?
Yeah. There was a lot of it.
He led Tiger to the front door and did everything short of pushing him out. After being an apprentice for nearly 3 months, Citra couldn't deny that she wanted to be chosen by Scythe Faraday to receive the ring. As much as she resisted, as much as she told herself this was not the life for her, she had come to see its importance and how good a scythe she would be. She had always wanted to live a life of substance and to make a difference. As a scythe, she would. Yes, she would have blood on her hands, but blood can be a cleansing thing. It was certainly treated as such in Bocator. Citra found Black Widow Bocator to be the most physically demanding thing she had ever done. Their trainer was Scythe Ying Xing, who used no weapons but his own hands and feet to glean. He had taken a vow of silence, It seemed every scythe had surrendered something of themselves. Not because they had to, but because they chose to, as a way to pay for the lives they took.
What would you give up?
Rowan once asked Citra. The question made her uncomfortable.
If I become a scythe, I'm giving up my life, aren't I? I think that's enough.
You're also giving up a family, Rowan reminded her. She nodded, not wanting to speak to it. The idea of having a family was so far off to her. The idea of not having one felt equally distant. It was hard to have feelings about something she was years away from even considering. Besides, such things had to be kept far from her mind during Bokator. One's mind had to be clear. Citra had never taken any sort of martial art before. She had always been a non-contact sport kind of girl. Track, swimming, tennis. Any sport that had a clear lane line or net between her and her opponent. Bokator was the antithesis of that. Hand-to-hand, body-to-body combat. Even communication was entirely physical in the class, as their mute instructor would correct their positions as if they were action figures. It was all mind and body, without the brash mediation of words. There were 8 in their class, and although their instructor was a scythe, Citra and Rowan were the only apprentices. The others were junior scythes in the first years of their scythehood. There was one other girl who made no overtures of friendship to Citra. The girls were given no special treatment, and were expected to be every bit the equal of the boys. Sparring was punishing in Bokator. Each match began simply enough, with a ritual strutting around the circle, and 2 combatants physically taunting each other in a sort of aggressive dance. Then things got serious, and brutal. All nature of kicks and punches and body slams. Today she sparred against Rowan. He had more finesse to his moves, but she had the advantage of speed. He was stronger, but he was also taller, which was not an asset. Citra's lower center of gravity made her more stable. All taken into account, they were evenly matched. She spun and gave Rowan a powerful kick to the chest that almost took him down.
Good one,
Rowan said. Scythe Yingxing zipped his own lips to remind them that there was no crosstalk during combat. She came at him from his left and he countered so quickly she had no idea where his hand had come from. It was as if he suddenly had 3. She was thrown off balance, but only for an instant. She felt heat where his hand had connected with her side.
There'll be a bruise,
she grinned.
He'll pay for that.
She feinted left again, then came at him from the right with the full force of her body. She took him down and had him pinned, but it was as if gravity reversed and suddenly she realized he had turned the tables. Now he was on top, pinning her. She could have flipped him again. She had the leverage. But she didn't do it. She could feel his heartbeat now as if it were beating in her own chest. And she realized she wanted to feel that a little longer. She wanted to feel it more than she wanted to win the match. That made her angry. Angry enough to pull away from his grip and put some space between them. There was no lane line, no net. Nothing to keep them apart but the wall of her will. But that wall kept losing bricks. Scythe Yingxing signaled the end of the match. Citra and Rowan bowed to each other, then took their places on opposite sides of the circle, as 2 others were called up to spar. Citra watched intently, determined not to give Rowan a single glance.
We are not the same beings we once were. Consider our inability to grasp literature and most entertainment from the mortal age. To us, the things that stirred mortal human emotions are incomprehensible. Only stories of love pass through our post-mortal filter. Yet even then, we are baffled by the intensity of longing and loss that threatens those mortal tales of love. We could blame it on our emo nanites limiting our despair, but it runs far deeper than that. Mortals fantasized that love was eternal and its loss unimaginable. Now we know that neither is true. Love remained mortal while we became eternal. Only scythes can equalize that. But everyone knows the chance of being gleaned in this or even the next millennium is so low as to be ignored. We are not the same beings we once were. So then, if we are no longer human, what are we? From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 11. Indiscretions.
Citra and Rowan were not always together at gleanings. Sometimes Scythe Faraday took just one of them. The worst gleaning Citra witnessed took place in early May, just a week before Vernal Conclave, the first of three conclaves she and Rowan would attend during their apprenticeship. Their quarry was a man who had just turned the corner and reset his age to 24. He was at home, having dinner with his wife and two kids, who seemed to be around Citra's age. When Scythe Faraday announced who they had come for, the family wept, and the man slipped off into a bedroom. Scythe Faraday had chosen a peaceful bloodletting for the man, but that was not what happened. When Citra and the Scythe entered the room, he ambushed them. The man was in peak condition, and in the arrogance of his new rejuvenation, he rejected his gleaning and fought the Scythe, breaking his jaw with a vicious punch. Citra came to his aid, trying some Bukator moves she had learned from Scythe Yingxing, and quickly learned that applying a martial art is much different from practice in a dojo. The man swatted her away and advanced on Faraday, who was still reeling from his injury. Citra leaped on him again, clinging to him, for the moment giving up on anything beyond eye gouging and hair pulling. It distracted him just long enough for Scythe Faraday to pull out a hunting knife he had concealed in his robe and slit the man's throat. He began gasping for air, his hands to his neck, trying futilely to hold back the flow of blood. And Scythe Faraday, holding a hand to his own swelling jaw, spoke to him. Not with malice, but with great sorrow.
"Do you understand the consequences of what you've done?"
The man could not answer. He fell to the ground, quivering, gasping. Citra thought death from such a wound would be instantaneous, but apparently not. She had never seen so much blood.
"Stay here," the Scythe told her. "Look upon him kindly, and be the last thing he sees."
Then he left the room. Citra knew what he was going to do. The law was very clear as to the consequences of running from or resisting one's gleaning. She couldn't close her eyes, because she was instructed not to. But if there was a way, she wished she could have closed her ears, because she knew what she was about to hear from the living room. It began with pleas from the woman, begging for the lives of her children, and the children sobbing in despair.
"Do not beg," Citra heard the Scythe say sharply. "Show these children more courage than your husband did."
Citra kept her gaze fixed on the dying man's until his eyes finally emptied of life. Then she went to join Scythe Faraday, steeling herself for what was to come. The two children were on the sofa, their sobs having degraded into tearful whimpers. The woman was on her knees, whispering to them, comforting them.
"Are you quite done?"
the Scythe said impatiently. At last the woman rose. Her eyes were tearful, but they no longer seemed pleading.
"Do what you have to do," she said.
"Good," said the Scythe. "I applaud your fortitude. Now, as it happens, your husband did not resist his gleaning."
Then he touched his swelling face.
"However, my apprentice and I had an altercation resulting in these wounds."
The woman just stared at him, her jaw slightly unhinged. So was Citrus. The Scythe turned to Citra and glared at her.
"My apprentice shall be severely disciplined for fighting with me."
Then he turned back to the woman.
"Please, kneel."
The woman fell to her knees, not so much a kneel as a collapse. Scythe Faraday held out his ring to her.
"As is customary, you and your children shall receive immunity from gleaning for 1 year henceforth. Each of you, please kiss my ring."
The woman kissed it. Again, and again, and again. The Scythe said little after they left. They rode a bus because whenever possible the Scythe avoided the use of a public car. He saw it as an extravagance. When they got off at their stop, Citra dared to speak.
"Shall I be disciplined for breaking your jaw?"
Citra knew it would be healed by morning, but the healing nanites were not spontaneous. He still looked pretty awful.
"You will speak of this to no one," he told her sternly. "You will not even comment on it in your journal, is that clear? The man's indiscretion shall never be known."
"Yes, Your Honor."
She wanted to tell him how much she admired him for what he had done, choosing compassion over obligation. There was a lesson to be learned in every gleaning, and today's was one she would not soon forget. The sanctity of the law,
and the wisdom to know when it must be broken. Citra, try as she might to be a stellar apprentice, was not immune to indiscretion herself. One of Citra's nightly chores was to bring Scythe Faraday a glass of warm milk before bed.
As in my childhood, warm milk smoothed the edges of the day, the scythe had told her. I have, however, dispensed with the cookie that once came with it.
The thought of a scythe having milk and cookies before bed bordered on absurd to Citra, but she supposed even an agent of death would have guilty pleasures. Quite often, however, when a gleaning had been difficult, he would fall asleep before she came into his room at the appointed time with the milk. In those cases, she would drink it herself or give it to Rowan, because Scythe Faraday made it clear that nothing in his household was ever wasted. On the night of that awful gleaning, she lingered in his room a bit longer.
Scythe Faraday, she said gently,
then said it again. No response. She could tell by his breathing he was out. There was an object on the nightstand. In fact, it was there every night. His ring. It caught the oblique light spilling in from the hallway. Even in the dim room, it glittered. She downed the glass of milk and set it on the nightstand so that in the morning the scythe would see she had brought it and that it hadn't been wasted. Then she knelt there, her eyes fixed on the ring. She wondered why he never slept with it, but felt that asking would be some sort of intrusion. When she received hers, if she received hers, would it retain the solemn mystery that it held for her now, or would it become ordinary to her? Would she come to take it for granted? She reached forward, then drew her hand back, then reached forward again, and gently took the ring. She turned it in her fingers so that it caught the light. The stone was big, about the size of an acorn. It was said to be a diamond, but there was a darkness in its core that made it different from a simple diamond ring. There was something in the core of that ring, but no one knew what it was. She wondered if even the scythes themselves knew. The center wasn't exactly black. It was a deep discoloration that looked different depending on the light, the way a person's eyes sometimes do. Then, when she glanced at the scythe, she could see that his eyes were open and watching her. She froze, knowing she was caught, knowing that putting the ring down now wouldn't change that.
Would you like to try it on? Scythe Faraday asked.
No, she said. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have touched it.
You shouldn't have, but you did.
She wondered if he had been awake this whole time.
Go ahead, he told her. Try it on. I insist.
She was dubious, but did as she was told, because in spite of what she told him, she did want to try it on. It felt warm on her finger. It was sized for the scythe, so it was too large for her. It was also heavier than she imagined.
Do you worry that it will ever be stolen? She asked.
Not really. Anyone foolish enough to steal a scythe's ring is quickly removed from the world, so they cease to be a problem.
The ring was getting noticeably cooler.
It is a covetable object, though, don't you agree? The scythe said.
Suddenly Citra realized the ring wasn't just cool, it was freezing. The metal, in a matter of seconds, had grown white with frost, and her finger was in such intense pain from the cold that she cried out and pulled the ring from her hand. It flew across the room. Not only was her ring finger severely frostbitten, so were the fingers that had pulled it free. She bit back a whimper. She could now feel warmth flowing through her body as her healing nanites released morphine. She became woozy, but forced herself to stay alert.
A security measure I installed myself, the scythe said. A micro-coolant chip in the setting. Let me see.
He turned on his nightstand light and grabbed her hand, looking at her ring finger. The flesh at the joint was pale blue and frozen solid.
In the age of mortality, you might have lost the finger. But I trust your nanites are already mending the damage.
He let go of her hand.
You'll be fine by morning. Perhaps next time you'll think before touching things that don't belong to you.
He retrieved his ring, set it back on the nightstand, then handed her the empty glass.
From now on, Rowan will bring me my evening milk, he said.
Citra deflated.
Sorry I disappointed you, Your Honor. You're right. I don't deserve to bring you your milk.
He raised an eyebrow.
You misunderstand. This is not a punishment. Curiosity is human. I merely allowed you to get it out of your system. I have to say, it took you long enough.
Then he gave her a little conspiratorial grin.
Now, let's see how long it takes Rowan to go for the ring.
Sometimes, when the weight of my job becomes overwhelming, I begin to lament all the things lost when we conquered death. I think about religion, and how, once we became our own saviors, our own gods, most faiths became irrelevant. What must it have been like to believe in something greater than oneself, to accept imperfection and look to a rising vision of all we could never be? It must have been comforting. It must have been frightening. It must have lifted people from the mundane, but also justified all sorts of evil. I often wonder if the bright benefit of belief outweighed the darkness its abuse could bring. There are the tone cults, of course, dressing in sackcloth and worshipping sonic vibrations. But like so many things in our world, they seek to imitate what once was. Their rituals are not to be taken seriously. They exist merely to make the passing time feel meaningful and profound. Lately, I've been preoccupied with a tone cult in my neighborhood. I went into their gathering place the other day. I was there to glean one of the cult's congregants, a man who had not yet turned his first corner. They were intoning what they called the resonant frequency of the universe. One of them told me that the sound is alive and that harmonizing with it brings inner peace. I wonder, when they look at the great tuning fork that stands as the symbol of their faith, if they truly believe it to be a symbol of power, or are they just joining in a communal joke?
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie.
12. No room for mediocrity.
The Scythedom is the world's only self-governing body, said Scythe Faraday. While the rest of the world is under Thunderhead rule, the Scythedom is not, which is why we hold conclaves 3 times a year to resolve disputes, review policy, and mourn the lives we've taken.
Vernal Conclave, which was to take place during the first week of May, was less than a week away.
Rowan and Citra had studied enough of the structure of the Scythedom to know that all 25 regions of the world held their conclaves on the same day, and that there were currently 321 scythes in their region, which encompassed the heart of the North American continent.
The Mid-American conclave is an important one, Scythe Faraday told them, because we tend to set the trend for much of the world. There's an expression, as goes Mid-America, so goes the planet. The Grand Slayer scythes of the global conclave always have their eyes on us.
Scythe Faraday explained that at each conclave they would be tested. I do not know the nature of this first test, which is why you need to be as prepared as possible in all aspects of your training.
Rowan found he had a million questions about conclave, but kept them to himself. He let Citra do all the asking, mainly because the questions irritated Scythe Faraday and he never answered them.
You'll find out all you need to know when you get there, the Scythe told them. For now, all your attention must be on your training and your studies.
Rowan had never been an exceptional student, but that was by design. To be either too good or too bad drew attention. As much as he hated being the lettuce, it was his comfort zone.
If you apply yourself, I have no doubt you could be at the top of your class, his science teacher told him after getting the highest grade on his midterm last year.
He had done it just to see if he could. Now that he knew, he saw no great need to do it again. There were many reasons, not the least of which was his own ignorance about scythes in those days before his apprenticeship. He assumed that being a stellar student would make him a target. Supposedly, a friend of a friend was gleaned at 11 because he was the smartest kid in 5th grade. It was nothing more than an urban myth, but Rowan believed it, just enough, that it kept him from wanting to stand out. He wondered if other kids held back for fear of being gleaned. He had little experience with being so studious. He found it exhausting, and there was more than just poison chemistry, post-mortal history, and journaling. There was metallurgy, as it applies to weapons, the philosophy of mortality, the psychology of immortality, and the literature of the Scythedom, from poetry to the wisdom found in famous Scythe's journals. And of course,
the mathematical statistics that Scythe Faraday relied upon so heavily. There was no room for mediocrity, especially now with Conclave coming up. Rowan did ask one question about Conclave.
Will we be disqualified if we fail the test?
Faraday took a moment before answering. No, he told them. But there is a consequence, although he would not tell them what that consequence was. Rowan concluded that not knowing was more terrifying than knowing. With just a few days before Conclave, he and Citra stayed up late studying in the weapons den. Rowan found himself dozing, but was quickly awakened when Citra slammed a book.
I hate this, she announced.
Cerberin, aconite, conium, polonium, the poisons are all running together in my head.
That would sure make a person die faster, Rowan said with a smirk.
She crossed her arms.
Do you know your poisons?
We're only supposed to know 40 by Conclave, he pointed out.
And do you know them?
I will, he told her.
What's the molecular formula for tetrodotoxin?
He wanted to ignore her, but found he couldn't back away from the challenge. Perhaps a bit of her competitive nature was rubbing off on him.
C11H17N306.
Wrong,
she said, pointing a finger at him.
It's 08, not 06. You fail.
She was trying to rile him up, so she wouldn't be the only one riled. He wasn't going to oblige.
Guess so,
he said, and tried to return to his studies.
Aren't you the least bit worried?
He took a breath and closed his book. When Faraday first began teaching them, Rowan found the use of actual, old-school books very off-putting. But over time, he'd learned there was something very satisfying to the turning of pages and, as Citra had already discovered, the emotional catharsis of slamming a book shut.
Of course I'm worried, but here's the way I look at it. We know they won't disqualify us, and we already know we can't be gleaned, and we'll have two more chances to make up for any screw-ups before one of us is chosen. Whatever the consequence of failing the first round of tests, if either of us fail, we'll deal with it.
Citra slumped in her chair.
I don't fail, she said.
That didn't sound too convinced of it. There was this pouty look on her face that made Rowan want to smile. But he didn't, because he knew that would infuriate her. He actually liked how she would get infuriated. But they had too much work to do to indulge in emotional distraction. Rowan put away his toxicology book and pulled out his volume on weapons identification. They were required to be able to identify 30 different weapons, how to wield them, and their detailed history. Rowan was more worried about that than the poisons. He spared a glance at Citra, who noticed the glance, so he tried not to look at her again. Then, out of nowhere, she said,
I would miss you.
He looked up, and she looked away.
How do you mean? I meant that if disqualification was part of the rules, I'd miss having you around.
He considered reaching out to take her hand, which rested gently on the table. But the table was big, and her hand was too far away for it to be anything other than insanely awkward. Then again, even if they sat closer, it would be an insane thing to do.
But it's not part of the rules, he said.
Which means that no matter what, you're stuck with me for 8 more months.
She grinned.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll be really sick of you by then.
It was the first time it occurred to Rowan that she might not hate him as much as he thought she did. The quota system has worked for over 200 years, and although it fluctuates region to region, it makes it crystal clear what each side's responsibility to the world is. Of course, it's all based on averages. We can go days or even weeks without gleaning, but we must meet our quota before the next conclave. There are those eager ones who glean early and find themselves with little to do as conclave draws near. There are those who procrastinate and have to hurry toward the end. Both those approaches lead to sloppiness and unintentional bias. I often wonder if the quota will ever change, and if so, how much? Population growth is still off the charts, but it's balanced by the Thunderhead's ability to provide for an ever-increasing population. Renewable resources, subsurface dwellings, artificial islands, and all without there being any less green or a sense of overcrowding. We have mastered this world, and yet protected it in a way that our forefathers could scarcely have dreamed. But all things are limited. While the Thunderhead does not interfere with the Scythedom,
It does suggest the number of scythes there should be in the world. Currently, there are approximately 5 million people gleaned per year worldwide.